even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We are go for launch. Okay, all flight controllers, let's play it cool.
All engines are started.
That looks really good.
So we'd like it to stir up your cryo tank.
Oh, wow, it's going up so slowly.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Welcome to Space Boffins. We're back to our tried and tested formula of two hosts, a studio, and two excellent guests. Although you should probably be the judge of that. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientist. I'm Richard Hollingham. And here's my co-host, or do you prefer presenter?
I think queen or she who must be obeyed.
Yeah, anyway, Sue Nelson.
Yes, our guests are the science and space writer Oliver Morton, who is also the briefings editor of The Economist, and space insurer and engineer David Wade of the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium. Now, we're going to be discussing a return to the moon and giant rockets. The two are, of course, connected with a report, too, from Richard from NASA. And we'll also celebrate Apollo 10, a mission that almost went disastrously wrong.
We found out, yeah, we are vulnerable, no matter how good we thought we were, no matter how many times we rehearsed it, you can screw up.
David, we should, I think, clarify before we go any further. You don't actually insure space. you insure the things that go into space.
Yeah, we insure the rockets that take the satellite into space, and we insure the satellites once they're in space, yeah.
Now, I know we've asked you this before, because you've been a guest on the podcast before. Why? Why do you need insurance if you're launching stuff?
But typically, the bank will not lend you the money unless you have the insurance. So, you know, some of these projects are tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, a very large communication satellite now might be $600 million. And no bank, no investor is going to put that kind of capital into a project unless they know that they've got some security to pay them back if something goes wrong.
I suppose it's extraordinary you think about it, because you're building this amazing machine and then sticking it on a rocket.
There's no other way at the moment, though. You know, we've still got that same technology that we've been relying on all these years. You know, it's rocket technology is the only way to take us there until we get something like a space elevator or, you know, some new opportunity that will take payloads up into space.
I would like to say that I would like to be insured if I was travelling on a space elevator as
well. Yeah. Oliver, it's the 50th anniversary of the moon landings, as I think I'm pretty sure most of our listeners will know that this year. It's a pretty crowded market for moon books at the moment, but naturally we're only featuring the best ones. Your one is The Moon, A History for the Future. Who would you say it's aimed at?
Well, I would say it's aimed at people who are interested in the moon and people who aren't interested in the moon. I'm trying to cover the waterfront.
So,
but it's not a book that's saying, yay, moon, you've always wanted to know more about the moon, because obviously there are lots of people who do, and they might buy a moon book anyway. But it's also a book about for people who say, I just see the moon sometimes, and I kind of wonder. And it talks a little bit about that, about the moon as this sort of like little bit of the Earth off in the sky that's part of our lives and maybe part of our futures and part of how we've thought about the world in past times.
And it's beautifully written and very poetic, and we'll hear a lot more about it later. But I just want to ask, you've got an endorsement there from Rusty Schweikart at the beginning, who's from Apollo 9, astronaut. How did you manage that one?
I met Rusty when I was a journalist interested in, and he was thinking a lot about the danger of killer asteroids. Rusty used to run something called the B612 Foundation, which existed to alert people to the fact that now and then asteroids hit the Earth, and by and large, that's something that you want to avoid. And we got on very well and kept in touch a little bit, and I can't claim that I've got a Rolodex that's absolutely full of magnificent Apollo astronauts.
We have.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Also, and you know, because I'm fond of Rusty, I gave him the book and said, what do you think of this? And he was kind enough to say that he liked it.
Oh, fabulous.
I spoke to Rusty only the other day.
Oh, God. I knew they'd be trying up that.
No, he is delightful. Absolutely delightful.
I've never met him.
He was in the last podcast. Yes, I still haven't met him.
I think one thing that's wonderful about Rusty is that he was the first person ever to get any really unscheduled time on a spacewalk, because when he was outside Apollo 9, I think Jim McDivitt had to move from one hatch to another to change a camera angle or something. And so Rusty was the first person who was just hanging there with nothing to do. And years later, he wrote a wonderful sort of like prose poem about it called No Frames, No Boundaries. Wonderful piece of writing.
Oh. Yeah, no, I think he is one of the most thoughtful astronauts. He also took with him, I didn't know this till the other day, we were interviewing him for this World Service Program that I'll mention later. I'll mention it a lot later because I'm really pleased with it. But he actually took quotes up with him. He would spend his Sunday nights listening to classical music at home. On Sunday nights, he'd put the kids to bed and sit in his study going through quotes that he would then take with him up into space. I mean, how many of those Apollo astronauts would do that? I think he's an extraordinary, extraordinary man.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or is it me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to chat more about the future of lunar exploration later, but let's talk about the giant rockets you need to get there.
We have ignition sequence start. The engines are on. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit. We have liftoff. Liftoff at 7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Apollo 8, the first launch of a Saturn V rocket, still the most powerful launcher ever built. 50 years on, NASA is close to the first flight of its replacement, the SLS, or Space Launch System, designed to carry the crewed Orion capsule to the Moon and Mars. But do we actually need it?
Well, soon find out. It's been suggested, even reportedly by senior NASA figures, that the project might be scrapped. And several people on the Space Boffins Facebook page, actually, including Michael McLaughlin, have been asking why NASA couldn't use SpaceX's Falcon Heavy instead.
Well, before we get into that discussion, let's head to the Vehicle Assembly Building, the VAB, at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, which is a massive structure. You can see it for miles from the surrounding area. It's the building where they assembled the Saturn V and the Space Shuttle. Now it's being adapted for the SLS. Our guide is Ken Tenbush, a senior NASA engineer who's overseeing the project.
It is 525 feet tall, all open, so that you could build a vehicle like the Saturn V and Apollo, which stood 370 foot plus tall, and be able to still stack that one, step at a time, and then actually still even roll it out once even stored on a mobile launcher. So that's how big this vehicle is, that it can actually, basically process huge, gigantic, heavy lift type vehicles.
So tell me about the SLS. What is it? What does it stand for?
It's the most powerful vehicle that will ever be made. As powerful even as if you wanted to like to compare it to the Saturn V rocket, it's got 10% more power even of that vehicle, which was at the time is still the mark of, hey, this is the vehicle to try to resemble and try to meet that kind of power that vehicle had.
And what's its destination? What's the purpose of it? Because this is a whole, 50 years on after Apollo, this is a whole new ambition, really, for NASA.
It is, yeah. We'd wind up going to the moon first to basically almost like test out the capabilities of this vehicle, verify that it can, do long-duration space. And then eventually we'll look to, this has got the power to be able to take it to a direct insertion into a Mars mission, so that's the long-term goal, maybe two or three decades away.
And the Saturn V had these multiple stages. You go stage one, stage two, stage three. How is the SLS going to compare? Because you've got solid rockets instead or as well as.
Yeah, you've got that first stage of two solid rocket boosters that take you through to the first 2 minutes and a few seconds of flight. Really provide super high power on the order of 3.5, 3.6 million pounds of thrust between each booster. So you're looking at over 7 million pounds of thrust just from those two solids. And four engines, those four RS-25 engines, that again give you about 500,000 pounds of thrust per. So that's a lot of power at liftoff to be able to break that bond of gravity. You know, so you've got to be able to have a huge amount of force off that initial stage. So that's what the SLS rocket will give you. And that's why you're able to lift the amount of metric tons, you know, as far as into deep space, because you've got all that capability to lift all that mass right at liftoff.
But actually, you've got the engines, you've got a huge amount of fuel. You're only actually carrying four people at the top.
Four people at the top, but then also with the capability to bring in other payload as well in the future, which is really the key to that long-duration space travel. Even this first vehicle that we have here, that's going to get upgraded through, you know, this first vehicle is a block. They call it like a block design. And we'll have a block 1B design that'll get us even more. And then finally a block 2 design of the same vehicle. When we're actually done, we'll go from a 70 metric ton kind of payload capability out to about 130, 135 metric ton capability. Because you're going to need to bring in, you know, a quarter of a million pounds of everything else you need for supplies for a deep space mission. Or even if you were to try to colonize the moon or colonize Mars, you still need that capability to be able to take that kind of heavy payload and support structure that you're going to need for those deep space missions.
Just describe then what we're looking at, because we've got the vehicle assembly building, and we're in a older part, if you like, of the building. And, you know, this dates back to the 1960s, built for Saturn V. Then we look across from the other side of the main bay here, this great high building. And, you know, we're pretty high up, and there's still more above us. And then you've got all this new section over here. So what are you building here at the moment?
Right now, what you've got here is a mobile launcher, and this is the structure that will wind up going out to the pad and give you all the different umbilical, pneumatic, electrical, hydraulic, all the other things that you're going to need as far as with the umbilicals that actually provide all the other commodities to this particular vehicle to be able to process it. All that's going to be done right here off the mobile launcher as they actually take it out to the pad. So you got this huge structure and capability to be able to bring that into the launch vehicle and to the Orion spacecraft. And so, yeah, that's a huge structure that is basically going to be your ability to be able to carry it out to the pad so you can launch it at the pad. There's a crawler transporter that has to come up underneath that, lift that up, and actually bring that out and then drop that onto stanchions out at the pad and then get it ready for launch. So it's again, you got to be able to support that through all kinds of different umbilicals to each of those parts of this spacecraft, from top to bottom.
Now, I can't help but notice there's no SLS in here yet. What's your timeline looking like? I mean, how soon will you start to get hardware in here and then start thinking about, well, actually launching?
We actually do have some hardware here. There's some over at the SSPF. And so, yeah, we do have, and right there we have the Orion stage adapter. It's already been built and shipped here to KSC, kind of monitoring that, maintaining it while we're waiting to lift that in here. But the pole that we're kind of waiting for here a little bit is the actual core stage. They're building that. They've, you know, got sections of that built. It's being built at MAF, at Michoud Assembly Facility in New Orleans. And so once that gets here, you know, don't have an exact time frame, but yeah, the got some solid rocket boosters in Promontory, Utah. They're already built. They're ready to be shipped. So the pieces are there. It's just a matter of waiting for everything to be ready to be put together. And once that core stage is complete, it'll be shipped here and we'll be ready to go.
You seem pretty fired up. I mean, is there genuine buzz around all this?
Always. When you're part of something this incredible, you know, to build a launch vehicle that can actually take us into deep space, a launch vehicle that can carry huge amounts of payloads to be able to allow that to happen, yeah, it's great to be part of something so enormous, so much bigger than you yourself, you know. But all the teaming and everything that has to be done to make that happen, it's an incredible piece of work for humankind.
That's Ken Tenbush, and yes, it was a very cool location in the Vehicle Assembly Building. I mean, he used all these imperial measurements, and I can never quite get my head around those. Basically, 525 feet tall, it's high. It's so big, it has its own weather system. So you can actually get clouds, you can actually be inside, and it rains in the Vehicle Assembly Building. That's how big it is. Also, I want to say, where we were standing, and I didn't mention that in the interview, you know the film Apollo 13?
The one you're obsessed
with. The best space film ever made. When early on, where Tom Hanks, the Jim Lovell character, is being told he's going to the moon by Deke Slayton, they're standing on that balcony and the rocket's being assembled by them. That's where I'm standing.
Oh, that's cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I have been in that building, actually, when I did the Orion launch a couple of years ago. But just being at the bottom looking up, and for our European and British listeners, I worked out it's about 170 metres high, all this feet and pounds.
Oh, I couldn't quite get my head around. Oh, SSPF, what do we think that is?
Sun protection factor.
I think it's the Space Shuttle Payload Facility.
That would sound good.
Processing facility.
Sorry. No, that's why you're here. Now, I've been reporting on the SLS for quite a few years now. I've been lucky enough, and I think we've heard it in the podcast, to see it under construction in New Orleans. David, what do you make of it, the SLS?
I think it's a fantastic vehicle, and it's probably what we do need if we're going to go back to the moon and onto Mars. I've read the article sort of saying, you know, why can't we use smaller vehicles? But it's all about the capability, all about the mass that you can take into orbit. As Ken said in that interview, you know, we're talking 100 tons at a time that we need to take into orbit. And even something like Falcon Heavy, which is a massive rocket by modern standards, can still only take 60 tons or so into low Earth orbit. So, you know, you really do need a lot of capability up there. You need a lot of fuel as well as all of your assets to take you out there, to land, to bring you back again. You know, and it's probably going to take a vehicle of that size to be able to assemble.
And as he said, in terms of a moon base, if you are going to take up your equipment first and build your habitat and things like that, then actually that does make it far more suitable than a Falcon Heavy.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, if you're going to build things in stages, if you're going to launch items on smaller vehicles, you then need somewhere to assemble it. So you probably need something like the lunar orbital platform in orbit around the moon. You've got to build that. You've then got to launch fuel, to refuel your lander when you get there. So there's a lot of capability, a lot of mass that has to be taken up and put in position.
So it still makes sense to have one big rocket rather than lots of little ones, putting lots of stuff up and putting it together in orbit.
I think you could do it either way, but certainly if you're going to assembly in orbit is not an easy task. You know, we've seen that in the past, but it's not something that's fantastically easy to do.
Can I be the naysayer here?
Absolutely.
I think it's a terrible rocket. and I think the justifications for it, with all respect, are a little bit dodgy. Going to the it's a terrible rocket side, it's really being built with updated versions of 80s and 70s technology.
Yeah.
It's estimated that it's going to cost something along the lines of $1 billion a launch, partly because of the very low cadence of launch and a very large number of people who have to work on the project. Now, for $1 billion, you can buy quite a lot of Falcons. And the whole point, as I remember it, the whole justification on which the space station was sold was that it was going to teach people how to assemble things in orbit. And so if you go from having spent over $100 billion on the space station and say, but we still have to launch things in jolly great big lumps, then I think that the space station has clearly not done what it was meant to do, unless what it was meant to do was maintain NASA's capability to go on spending money in the southern states of America.
What do you think, David?
The saving launching Falcon 9, Falcon Heavies may not be as great as you think. I mean, that 60-ton capability to low Earth orbit is a fully expendable Falcon Heavy, so you're throwing the rocket away every time. That's $150 million.
I thought two of the firsts came back.
Now, if you recover the vehicle, then your capability to low Earth orbit is more like 20 tons. So you're looking at five flights of a Falcon Heavy in reusable format to equate to one of the SLS.
So actually,
so
when
that's
you start
still
with
saving money, then that's still
it's still
half
saving
the price.
Money, but then you've got the additional cost of assembly in orbit, which is an expensive.
Isn't
operation.
There another issue here that one is public and one is private? Isn't there something to be said,
but
David,
SpaceX
for something to
couldn't
be?
Couldn't exist without
no,
the
no,
injection
I'm arguing
of public
the other,
money.
No, I'm not
yeah.
arguing that, that actually...
I'm not trying to defend SLS in particular, Elon Musk is now working on the BFR. Now, that will have a similar capability. Now, maybe that's the way to go. It's a single big rocket developed commercially. Maybe that's the answer. I'm not sort of trying to defend SLS over everything else. The only issue there is that it's probably not going to be ready in the time frame that Mike Pence and Donald... Trump now want to be able to land people on the moon within 5 years.
Well, actually, that was the thing that made me sort of go, oh, when I heard that interview, was the time frame. Because, as we know, for the last decade, they've been talking about getting to Mars 2020, 2030s. And then all of a sudden he said 2 to 3 decades away. Well, that's basically approaching 2050. Now, that's an enormous rescale of your ambitions. That to me was so telling in terms of, because normally any personnel at NASA are so on message. So that's obviously the new figure, and like you say, Oliver, the sort of SLS is, and we've seen the mock-ups of the capsule, and you only have to see it when yourself online or whatever. It does look like an big Apollo capsule. On a great big rocket.
That's the other point, because it is designed. I mean, the Falcon Heavy isn't designed to launch Orion. SLS is designed to launch the Orion spacecraft.
Yeah, isn't that isn't that almost exactly a question of putting a cart before a horse? I think, you design a rocket that can do good things. But I want to go back to some other things that came up in that talk. So, for instance, we were talking about how you'd seen the spacecraft, you'd seen the SLS under construction in New Orleans, which is, not Kennedy. And they were talking about bringing down the solid rocket boosters from Utah, which is, again, not Florida. Mm. Whereas one of the advantages, I think, I have no idea whether the BFR, and I'm glad we're not talking any of that sort of like Starship stuff, it's the BFR. I have no idea whether the BFR is going to work well or not, but I do think that making it in the place where you're going to launch it is fairly obviously a good idea. But you can't do that if you're NASA, because you have to keep the people in the different states happy. And so that's why, in Washington, my understanding, it's referred to almost always as the Senate launch system. Not the space launch system, because it's the Senate that likes it. And so you really do have this situation where a launch system is being built purely so that a launch system can be built. And I'm not denying that it could have some uses. But if you were going to stop and say, how do we build a space infrastructure going on from here, you would not say, with space shuttle main engines and some solid rocket boosters. It's just not what you would do.
But, if we look back at this, Apollo was a wholly political project. It was a political ambition to get to the moon by the end of the decade. It became this amazing technological engineering scientific project, but it was only ever, let's get to the moon before the Soviet Union. And isn't this similarly a political project? And isn't it naive to think that anything NASA does isn't a political project?
No, I'm not often mistaken for a naive, it is a political. But the politics involved is what the French call the politics of the belly. It's the politics of spending money in Huntsville, Alabama, and other places around the United States. I mean, you can see this because the Saturn V was developed because America was going to the moon. The SLS has been developed because the SLS needs to be developed. The uses have swung back and forth between Mars and the moon and that weird cockamamie let's catch an asteroid thing.
Oh, yeah, we forgot about that.
Exactly.
That was the purpose a few years ago, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly. And now it's launching the Lunar Orbiting Gateway. And, you know, the idea is basically we have a need to build large rockets. Now let's do something with them. And that's not the way to do it.
It does seem like that, doesn't it, Dave, do you think? Sometimes that it's absolutely what Oliver says, the cart before the horse. We've got to build a rocket. What do we do with it now?
As you know, I'm much more about what we can do with satellites for the good of people on Earth. You know, these things are inspirational. They are political. I mean, you're right. I mean, we went to the moon because of the Russians. Trump probably wants to go back now, because of the Chinese landing there. I mean, there's probably nothing more to it than that. Those things are inspirational, and I think that has an element to play. Personally, I would much prefer to send robots on smaller rockets and use our money to put Earth observation satellites up to study the planet Earth.
What about, because you have to understand rockets and how they work to ensure them. I mean, what about the Russians? I mean, what are they out of the game now? Have they sort of taken a back seat and just carrying on with Soyuz and Proton, their tried and tested 60s technologies?
Pretty much so. The Zenit launch vehicle, which became Sea Launch, it was pretty much over now because that was part Ukrainian, so the Ukrainian and Russian link isn't working very well. Proton is still flying, but mainly domestic payloads. Very few Western satellites are now being launched on Proton. And Soyuz is still the workhorse, but we continue to see workmanship issues out of on the Russian vehicles as those best and brightest engineers from the 1960s hit retirement age and leave the industry, and they're being replaced by people who just don't have the understanding or the opportunity to learn on the job as much as they did in, say, the 60s. Yeah. So we keep on seeing
failures.
It's
very sad.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Very sad. Still to come, as promised, we'll talk moon bases and celebrate another of the missions that helped humanity reach the moon. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists. Our guests are engineer Dave Wade and writer and author of The Moon. Is that what it's called? No, I've written a bit.
Yeah, it's called The Moon.
Yeah,
it's called The Moon.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Moon, A History for the Future.
That's what I thought it was, The Moon.
But
okay.
It's got a colon.
Oh, has it? Okay. Our guests,
don't we all?
Yes. Our guests are engineer David Wade and writer and author of The Moon, Oliver Morton.
That sounds like The Moon.
The Moon.
Colon. Oliver Morton, doesn't it?
That's right.
Do get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. You can also email us info@boffinmedia.co.uk. We'll post some pictures of our recording today. We must remember to take some then.
I'm actually charging my phone.
And that means they'll be, slightly out of focus as per usual. And hopefully some good photos from you, Rich, from your recent recording in Florida.
Yes, so I was in Florida with astronaut Nicole Stott, who is fantastic, and I'll put those pictures up. It's for a BBC World Service documentary I've been making called 10987, which features the astronauts' perspectives on those incredible Apollo missions. It was, I have to tell you the story of this. It was originally called, and the nerd in me wanted to call it, because it's right, 7, 8, 9, 10, because it was in that order. But the World Service decided it sounded better as a countdown, 10987. We literally tossed a coin to decide what it's called. But I'm sort of come round to it now, 10987.
I think so, actually, me too.
Okay. Anyway, it features the astronauts' perspectives.
An insight
on those
into the BBC's production.
Yes, exactly. The BBC commissioning process, yes. It includes the inside track on the grumpy commander of Apollo 7. I'm really pleased with it. We'll put some more information of it up on our Facebook, Twitter feeds, and all the other things.
Well, as we've touched on it already in the podcast, everyone's talking about going back to the moon, with a noticeable shift in space agency rhetoric from destination Mars to destination moon. So where are we going to live when we get there? Oliver, you do actually, towards the latter part of the book, you do go into this. So it's, you're not just looking at phases explaining some of the, the science and that goes in. You look ahead as well.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. One of the things that's changed about the moon, people often say, so why are we going back to the moon when been there and then so obviously chose not to go back for really quite a long time. And one of the things that's driving both the interest in return and the likely destinations of return is the near certain discovery that there are frozen volatiles, specifically water, in the permanently darkened craters at the moon's poles, because the moon sits very properly upright in its orbit, and so at the poles the sun spends a lot of the time just going right round on the horizon. And if you're in a crater, and even better if you're in a crater inside a crater, and since basically all there is to the moon is craters, that's not so rare, you can find places where the sun never rises, and those places have had the chance to sort of like capture small little brief events of frost over the entire history of the solar system. So how much water there is in there, I don't think anyone really knows, and quite what form it is. But on the basis that water that you have to bring up from the Earth is expensive, and water that you just have to boil up in a kettle, I mean, a kettle that can work at 30 degrees absolute, so, you know, quite a kettle, but still a kettle, that's a big advantage. And so there's an interest in, there's, I think, a fairly strong consensus
yeah.
that an early base will be a polar base, either north or south. And in the announcement he made recently about this idea of America going back to the moon by 2024, Mike Pence, I think, specifically said the South Pole.
Yes, and it makes sense because the European Space Agency have also been looking at different concept designs, and they've always been seem to be a lot at the bottom of craters, which, as you say, makes sense because if you've got water, you've got hydrogen, you've got oxygen, you've got potential fuel source, make power source, electricity, and
The electricity, of course, is the other thing, is that you don't want to be in the bottom of the crater there, but you have the beautifully named by Claude Flammarion the peaks of eternal light at the poles, which these are the places which are always in sunlight, so the obverse of the perpetually shaded craters. And if you put a nice big sticky up mast with a solar panel on it there, you can get light for something like 80% of the time, and that's a huge saving when you consider that on most of the moon you get light for 50% of the time, and you have to have 2 weeks worth of battery backup. And that's a lot of battery power. So for that reason as well, for anything near, anything that you want, where you want to stay for a while rather than sort of like look around for a bit, the poles are the way to go.
So would the idea be a moon base would be somewhere between the two? So not right in, not in perpetual darkness and not in perpetual light? You
yeah,
put them and sort of at the top of the crater.
Look,
be able
well,
to
you
go
certainly,
down.
You probably... Probably wouldn't want to put in perpetual darkness because, you know, engineering in the cold.
Yeah.
Engineering in the cold is difficult. Engineering at sort of like 45 to 30K is that's really not something you want to do. Obviously, any sort of like long duration moon base is probably going to be either sort of like cut and covered with regolith or sort of like have some sort of like moon brick outer layer, because you don't want people dying in the solar proton events. So, yeah, you'll have it somewhere. I suspect also that just for psychological purposes, you'll probably want to have it somewhere where people coming in and out of it can see the Earth. I think that's a very important part of what the human experience of returning to the moon is going to be a sort of like deepening of that big iconic moment that the world shared when the pictures of Earthrise came back from Apollo 8. And I think you'd be kind of daft to build a moon base from which you can't see the Earth.
Well, actually, that ties in. I met quite a few space doctors, effectively, sort of flight surgeons, who are based at the European Astronaut Training Centre in Cologne. And that's one of the things that they said was most important, is that really a lot of the existing training that they're doing is pretty suitable for the space station as for the moon. Obviously, they'll have to think a little bit more in terms of the difference in from microgravity to one-sixth the gravity. But basically, it's very similar. But the thing that would be the issue is the psychological aspect, absolutely. And that's what happens, as we know, on places like Antarctica, where people always go a little bit barking, or in places where you're in perpetual darkness, like in the North Pole, where you don't get light for several months at a time, is making sure that you have those psychological aspects. That you are the right, have got the right mindset to deal with it. But also that's really interesting what you say, is that the psychological aspect of seeing something that uplifts the spirits, although it could, of course, have the opposite effect of making you feel totally alone and isolated. But again, it would depend on who you are, isn't it? Your glass half full.
You ideally don't choose those people.
No.
Is the technology there, Dave, to do these things? I mean, is it basically possible, assuming we're going to use the SLS?
The technology is there to build the base. It's a matter of getting the mass there. I mean, as Oliver said, you probably have to bury it to stop the radiation poisoning of the astronauts. But there's certainly the technology there in terms of a basic infrastructure. There's research going on looking at how you use that ice that you dig up to transform it. And there's companies now working on things like bulldozers and earth-moving equipment for the moon. So, I mean, there are companies who are already working on those technologies.
But you need that because you cover your base in a crater with tons and tons of regolith.
Yes.
Which is fine because the regolith's there. It's in plentiful supply, but you do need the equipment to move it there, because and that's where you get back to your robotic vehicles.
Yes,
and you need to carry them.
But you could send robots though, wouldn't you, Dave? You wouldn't bother with humans.
Yeah, I would envisage that you would have your crewed station on the edge of the crater. After a little bit of exploration of the floor of the crater, then you would send your robotic machines down there to do all of the actual work. You really don't want space-suited astronauts, hanging around heavy mechanical equipment. The danger of accidents then is just far too great.
Oliver, do you ultimately envisage a civilization on the moon, or at least in the same way we've got the space station, continuously occupied? Is that something we're looking at in the future, potentially with a moon base?
I always try to think about, what would someone in 1919, being asked about stuff happening in 1969, what would that person say? I think I honestly don't know. What I do know is that as part of the return to the moon, the human experience of the moon will be very different in various ways to the experience of the 1960s and 70s, because it will be an experience that will be shared by a greater range of people in the flesh. And so far, no woman has traveled beyond low Earth orbit. No one other than a white American male has. And that's going to change. That's very obviously going to change. You're also going to get the people who are sharing in the view, because you're not going to be looking back at the world that is just a world of superpower conflict and a world that you've never really seen that way before. You're going to be looking back at a world that is increasingly dominated by Asia. You're also going to be looking back not at an environment that you can say iconically, oh, we must protect this. You're going to be looking back at an Earth that is changing and has changed. And I think one of the interesting things is that, as Dave was saying, one of the challenges of any sort of like long-term moon base or anything like a lunar city or something like that is the environment. It's both keeping bits of the environment out, because moon dust is really nasty stuff that you don't want to be really having anything to do with, and keeping the cycling of carbon and oxygen and water going. And so I think in terms of thinking about the cycling of carbon and oxygen and water on the Earth, the moon will be a very interesting place to do it. But to go back to, I think that there might be I think the thing that's least likely is that there would be a civilization on the moon. There may be lots of little splinters of different civilizations. I don't think anyone will live on the moon in a sort of, I think it's unlikely that people will sort of like see the moon as a country. And there's also the huge question, we have no idea where the humans can give birth on the moon.
Oh, that's really interesting. And the gravity, the radiation, all the
gravity.
Rest of it.
Yeah. I mean, radiation, you can build shelters.
Yeah.
But no one knows how humans develop in low gravity.
It's 1/6 gravity or something.
It's like about 1/6. Yeah. So there's a haunting line. There's a short story by Walter J. Miller Walter Miller Jr., in the 1950s called The Line Man. And someone asks, why aren't there any women on the moon? Why aren't there any children? And he's pointed to the three graves in Lunar City that are 6 feet long of 6-year-old children who grew themselves to death. It's a That's a grisly little moment.
You do cover quite... I like the parts of the book where you cover a lot of the fiction that's been written about the moon. What for you has been the sort of most... Well, either the one you've enjoyed the most or the one that you find just sort of stimulates conversation the most or thoughts about it?
I think the one that matters the most in that it's inspired a lot of other people, both to think about the moon and to think about the Earth in various ways, is Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Because it imagines, it's not actually particularly interested in the engineering of the moon, except in the development of a mass driver to export things from the moon to the Earth. But it's very interested in this idea of a sort of like somewhat both strict and anarchic civilization that builds up. Because his view of the moon is that it's being used basically as a penal colony, because people on the moon can't come back to the Earth because they've adapted to the low gravity. And so it's this odd mixture of very tight control because of the environmental systems that have to be kept running, and incredibly loose control because actually within that anything goes. So there are all sorts of strange forms of marriage, all sorts of strange customs. I think that's a very enlightening book. The other one I'd really recommend at the moment, the best recent book about the moon, I think, is a book called The Moon and the Other by John Kessel, which is a description of an attempt to build a matriarchal utopia on the moon. It's an absolutely wonderful book.
Oh, I like the sound. I've not read either of those, so I've been writing them down.
I can actually imagine you as the queen of matriarchal utopia.
Yeah, we don't know whether they all live yet or not. No.
How ghastly it is.
Would you ensure a moon base, David?
We've certainly looked at missions to the moon. We were approached recently on one of the XPRIZE ventures, or the Lunar XPRIZE ventures. As long as the technology is proven and we can see that it's been used before, it's got heritage, it's an insurable risk. If anybody's got a mooncraft that they want to insure, give me a call.
See what we can do.
Yeah. Over the last few months here on Space Boffins, we've been counting down the missions that led to the first moon landing. Well, the final mission in May 1969 was Apollo 10, a test of the lunar lander in lunar orbit. On board, Commander Tom Stafford, Command Module Pilot John Young, and Lunar Module Pilot Gene Cernan. Spoiler alert, the mission was a tremendous success. But it almost went disastrously wrong. In his last broadcast interview before he sadly passed away, Gene Cernan told me what happened when they separated their ascent stage from the descent stage of the lander on the way back to the command module. You'll also hear from Jerry Woodfill, who was one of the engineers in Houston responsible for spacecraft alarm systems.
Snoop, Houston, we had you go for staging. Over.
I was operating an abort guidance computer we were going to practice with. Flip a switch over here on the left. Tom knew the switch had to be changed. He hand takes it and flips it over the other direction. And so now, there's a spacecraft out there on a primary guidance. I had put it on the abort guidance for this particular maneuver.
Here, the tap is set for a light vehicle. We'll do it this way. Okay, you ready?
And the spacecraft spun out of control when we tried to stage.
Son of a bitch.
Only 8.4 miles above the lunar, 50,000 feet. They're tumbling.
You been in a gimbal lock?
I saw the lunar horizon go by in different directions eight times in 15 seconds. Is that scary? Yeah, if you got time to be scared, but I didn't have time to be scared.
Okay, let's make this burn on the axe, babe.
Fortunately, Stafford decided what the only thing to do now is to just shut everything off and take over manual control. Don't let the computer orient the vehicle. Just do it manually.
Yep, who's up, babe?
There was 2 seconds. They got control of the lunar lander ascent stage 2 seconds before they would have crashed into the moon.
Snoop, Houston, we show you close to gimbal lock.
Yeah, okay, something went wild there on that staging. And we're all set. We didn't lock it. We're going ahead to the auto maneuver.
Roger.
Tom finally was able to take over manually, and God bless his soul, he literally saved my life, because they told us afterwards, had we gone around once or twice more, two things would have happened. We would have gone into what they called gimbal lock, where all our navigation equipment froze up. And you're really in trouble then. Or we would have taken enough energy out of our orbit that there would have been no choice, but we would have slowly drifted back down to the surface. But Tom was able to handle it. And like I say, he saved my life. So we found out, you know, we didn't have a hardware problem. We had a people problem. And we found out, yeah, we are vulnerable. No matter how good we thought we were, no matter how many times we rehearsed it, you can screw up if you're not careful. So you got to be careful you don't get too overconfident with what, oh, I've done that, boom, boom. And then you're in trouble.
Charlie, how was the stage?
Good, huh? Wait till that thing blinks.
Charlie Brown, Houston, they got staging. They had a wild gyration, though, but they got it under control. Over.
Gene Cernan talking to me back in 2017. I mean, what's so interesting about that? I was actually doing the interview with Gene Cernan about the Gemini missions and his Gemini mission, his spacewalk from hell, he called it, which was horrendous. And he just launched into this talking about suddenly Apollo 10. I didn't even ask him a question about it. And obviously felt, I think, you know, he was quite ill already at that stage. We didn't know it was going to be one of his last interviews. And we think that's his last broadcast interview. But he just started talking about Apollo 10 and kind of blaming himself for this incident on Apollo 10. You can hear more about that incident in 10987, which is coming up on the BBC World Service later this month. It's presented by shuttle astronaut Nicole Stott. And we also feature some really quite excellent music and Aka Bilk as well. They took some extraordinary music with them on the Apollo missions. They had these mixtapes they took with them on kind of precursors to Waltman's. And the one for that mission, it's like some sort of ghastly 60s easy listening compilation.
It's interesting. Brian Eno pointed out that they didn't take any tapes on Apollo 8, but 9 onwards they all took tapes. And he said the one common denominator was that everyone took some country. And that's why.
Apart from Rusty Swikeheart, actually.
No, I think he took some country too.
Oh, he said he didn't.
Oh, maybe not. Or
maybe he's trying to deny it.
Maybe it's that every mission had some country.
The mission did, yes, absolutely. Every mission did.
But he said that's why on his absolutely wonderful Apollo album that was used for Alan Reinert's film, he uses steel guitar. And that mixture of the steel guitar and the otherworldliness is just wonderful.
Well, I mean, they really took Houston into space with them. Mm-hmm. I think that's what, you know, you get. There's a couple of songs, and I didn't include them in the programme, but they're quite common, come up a lot. It's, Going Back to Houston is one of them, and Galveston, which I think is Glenn Campbell. Galveston, they both feature prominently. Now, the story of Rusty Swikeheart, so he had classical music. Mm-hmm. He took classical music, this which we're talking about, you know, he listened to at home. Mysteriously, for his mission, until the last day, his tape went missing. And it was only on the last day his tape mysteriously appeared. Dave Scott said, here's your tape. Is this what you've been looking for, Rusty? So obviously, you know, they didn't appreciate his music as much. They just had to, they did have very much
country
music.
That's a shame, because that would have been, as we know from 2001, a sort of classical backdrop to the vision out that window of the Earth would have been brilliant.
You have to listen to 10987 to hear what happened when he put the music on.
Oh, okay. Well, that's it for Space Boffins for this month. Thank you very much to our guests, David Wade and Oliver Morton, whose book, A History for the Future, The Moon, A History for the Future even, is out in May?
It's out in May in the UK and in June in the US.
Excellent. In fact, I'll mention my book then, which is Wally Funk's Race for Space paperback. Actually, it was out in the States in March, paperback here in the UK in June. David, have you got
anything to plug?
Anything to plug?
Buy insurance. Buy insurance. with me.
Bonfire night, November the 5th.
When I write a book, I know where to come.
Okay. And yours,
Richard? I've got a book out on space dogs. This sounds so trivial, doesn't it? But listen to my program, 10987. It's really good.
Right, yeah, pictures,
Do get in touch with us. You know how. If you like us, leave us a review somewhere. If you don't do that. And do tell your friends about us. We'll be back next month. And thanks for listening.